Hello. In this audio snippet, we were planning to go back to a study of America in the post-Civil War period, and we were going to retake the presidency of Rutherford B. Hayes and move on to the next president. But for some reason, I felt this strong need that we needed to talk about this separate topic first, and it has to do with the branches of government. We had mentioned, if I'm not mistaken, in the previous audio snippet, how the three branches that were set up by the founding fathers in the current American Constitution didn't seem to be right. Every time I would look at them, it just felt like there was something out of sorts. And I know, for example, that many people believe that these three branches, the judicial, the legislative, and the executive branch are somehow divinely inspired. And I've seen places where Christians quote passages of scripture of the Bible to validate their claim that these three branches are, quote, divinely inspired. And I vaguely recall a passage somewhere in Jeremiah that they use to say, here's the executive branch, there's the legislative, and here is the judicial branch. But I don't remember the verse, but I don't think it's even worth analyzing. I remember it was almost like trying to force it into force it. Yes, and you could kind of make mental connections and kind of force make mental connections, but just do word association. But it was very mechanical, and but it's one thing to associate things mechanically just by words, and then it's another thing to look at their metaphysical essence and to see if there really is a match. And I remember that when I looked at it, it really it didn't seem to match. It was like just doing these word association things without really laying down what's really going on there. I believe that there is something fundamentally wrong with the division of government that was laid out in the current American Constitution by the founding fathers. And the important thing is we have to believe, and that's one of the first pillar that we talked about out of the 10 pillars of government. That there is a truth, an absolute truth, and it's independent of us. That's the first pillar of a proper constitutional system. So we have to believe that the truth is out there. We just have to find it. It's not a question of what we feel like the truth is, or it's not like the choice of color, like some people like red more than blue. Other people like yellow, or other people are fond of green. It's like a personal preference, but there is no right answer to what is your favorite color, if you see what I'm saying. But that does not apply to this. I mean, there is a truth, and it's not a question of just choosing what you like the most. What are the branches of government? And to get that, we have to look for some metaphysical foundation, something from which we can derive, okay, these are the branches that that we need to have in a perfect government, because a perfect government is a reflection of the metaphysical reality in the world. Just like when you're building a model, a computer model, let's say of some sort of organism, you have to make this model reflect the actual organism. And if it doesn't, then it's not going to work. So the question becomes, and it's not a, and I do believe it's not a matter of flavor. Like we can choose whatever flavor we want. No, there's one form of government. Maybe within that form of government, there are flavors you can pick where it doesn't matter if you pick blue or yellow or green. But in a wider sense, there is a truth that we have to get to. And if it's not within that truth, that context, or that framework, then it's wrong. So based on that idea that we have to get the branches of government from a metaphysical reality, then where do we start? And as I was thinking about this, it became very clear to me that the metaphysical reality we have to start from is the nature of man. And the government has to be a reflection of the nature of man. And we've talked about how nature of man is kind of can be divided, you could say, into five personalities. And there's a metaphysical truth to that. We have never really, you know, gone into detail of why, where those personalities come from. How do we know that there are five personalities? But we can talk about that at some other time. But let's take that as a proven fact. Let's say an established fact for now. Just for, and I hope that even if we haven't given out like a metaphysical proof, and I say that in quotes, of these five personalities, that they do resonate, and that's an important thing. When you encounter the truth, it just rings true. It's like it makes sense. It like opens things up. You see, okay, yeah, now that I see it this way, everything becomes clearer. It makes perfect sense. And I hope that when you've heard a saying about talking about these five personalities, that you do perceive that yes, that rings true. And those five personalities are judge, visionary, conqueror, server, and organizer. Those are the five fundamental personalities that people have. You know, some people have more than one. Some people just have one. And it's very rare if you find someone who kind of manifests all of them. But the thing is that those are the five facets of the human personality. There are two others that are wild card, as we have mentioned before, but it's like five and two. It's like that. That's how it works, you could say. So the perfect form of government should be derived from that metaphysical truth. Let's accept that as the metaphysical foundation, and then build from that. See, the founding fathers didn't think that way. With them, it was all very practical. It's like whatever the pardon my French, whatever the hell, you know. Came up, that's how they dealt with it. That's why they adopted federalism. Federalism is an outgrowth of history, the historical foundation of the country, because the country was founded based on colonies. Some people would come and they would ask permission from the monarchy in England to establish a settlement, and the king would grant them, you know, the right to settle, and they would come, they would settle. And that became a colony. And that's how we ended up with 13 separate colonies with their own form of government. So the federalism was an outgrowth of historical circumstances. It was not because somebody sat down and said, okay, the metaphysical reality is that a perfect form of government requires a federal system. They didn't take it from an abstract concept and then say, okay, we have reached this conclusion. No, it just happened, and they say, okay, that's how it is, then that's how it's going to be. They eternalized what was before them, if you see what I'm saying. That's how it is, so that's how it's going to be. So they took what was present and just projected it into the indefinite future and said, this is how it's going to be, instead of saying how it should be. And aiming towards what it should be instead of just taking what was and making it permanent. So the founding fathers never sat down to really think. I challenge anyone to tell me, to give me proof that they came up with the three forms of government based on some metaphysical foundation. where you can say, okay, it came from these abstract concepts. I don't think so. It just happened. You know, they had the executive branch because they needed like some form of the king. They came up with the House of Representatives because that was like the House of Commons in England, in Britain, and they came up with the Senate because that was the equivalent of the House of Lords, and they came up with a judiciary system. Judiciary branch, because they needed judges to judge stuff and judge cases, just like it was happening in England. So it was just this, just continuing with kind of what they had. And the only kind of major change you could say that they made, significant change, was that instead of a king, they had a president. But a rotating king, basically. You know, every 4 years, we had a chance to change the king. And the king had certain limitations, constitutional limitations, and that was it. And other than that, there was really nothing major that they did in terms of thinking it out. So let's think it out now. And if we start with the foundation of the five personalities, then the government should reflect those five personalities. And that means that you could basically say that there are five, there should be five branches. And when you start thinking of it in that sense, it starts making just perfect sense. And I hope that in this audio snippet, I don't think this one snippet will be enough to cover the whole thing. But in these audio snippets, I hope that you will see how it starts making perfect sense, and how as you start to lay it out in terms of five branches according to the five personalities, how all the contradictions and all the ambiguities and all the internal problems that were generated by the three branch division that we have right now, all those problems start withering away. They start disappearing. It's like finally you see, oh, this is why it wasn't working, because it was not metaphysically sound. It was not fundamentally, conceptually well designed, so it was bound to have problems from the get-go. And I hope you will see that as we talk this out. So the first branch of government would have to do with the first personality, the judge personality. And what does the judge personality do? People with the judge personality are people who operate in wisdom. Wisdom to make judgments and to come up with principles and laws and general concepts and definitions and things like that. And so the judge personality is like a law emanating personality. Out of a judge comes all these laws and principles and all these wisdoms. All these wise concepts and so forth. So you can see that from that personality, clearly, we see if you project it to a government branch, clearly that points to a legislative branch. And it would point to kind of what we can call a House of Representatives or a Congress, like similar to, at least on the surface, to what we have now with the House of Representatives in the American system. So it would be a branch that lays down laws and basic principles. It's the legislative branch, the one that produces bills and says, okay, this is how the laws we're going to live by and the principles that we're going to abide by. And this branch is the one that has to lay down all the laws. All laws must pass through that branch. There can be no sidestepping it, no one else usurping and saying, okay, I'm going to pass my own law, the way we have with the executive branch, with executive orders and the judicial branch, making up law, because the law is incomplete, the Constitution is incomplete, so they start making up their own laws and precedents and all this stuff. Why can a judge overturn... why can a judge allow or disable abortion when that should be a law? Why does he have the authority to, based on a decision, change the laws we live by? There's something not right there. And why can the FDA or all these agencies issue all these commandments and all these penalties and institute all these things upon the population if they are not part of the Congress. They don't have the authority to legislate. So in our form of our more perfect form of government, we'd have this legislative branch that is made up of this, you know, group of people elected from the people to represent the people, and that branch will be the one laying down all the laws and passing every law that affects the land. And it's only through them; no other branch can do that. And as we've tried to explain in previous audio snippets, this House of Representatives would look very different from what we have now, because it would be partyless. There'd be no party system. It's not how, you know, what party controls the House. That language would cease to exist, because it would be a House made up of individual men with no party affiliation. It doesn't matter if, let's say that even if they affiliate, they assign themselves labels like conservative or liberal or whatever. Even if they all choose, okay, let's all call ourselves conservatives or let's call ourselves liberals. Even if there's an informal labeling, it would be irrelevant, because there would be no election of a House of a Speaker, no one controlling the House. There'd be no what we've called power clots, individuals accumulating an excessive amount of power, because that's what happens with when they say the Republicans took over the House. What does that mean? That means that now they can elect the House of the Speaker of the House, and the Speaker of the House has the power to decide who is head of every committee, you know, committee chairmanships. They can disband, they have power to disband committees and create new ones. They have the power to change the rules by which votes are cast, and they have all this power. That come, and why do they get that power? It comes from their party having won. So the party wins, they control certain things. So there's all this power clotting going on. And so it's not, as it stands now, a House of individual men who stand on their own principles and who have each of them the same, who are all equal in power or ability to influence legislation. Because now you have to start kissing butt, you have to kiss the Speaker's butt, you have to start kissing the chairman's, committee chairman's butt, because if he doesn't approve of a bill or doesn't even let it into the committee, then it can't even go on the floor. So there's all these hurdles, all these people who start like they are like pay tolls, like toll booths. There are toll booths where you have to go pay a little bit, give a little bit of yourself to them, so that they will let you continue down the road. And we don't want toll booths. So it's not the correct form of a House would be a House of individual men with no party affiliation. And we've mentioned that there would be a House referee, but that person would just be there to ensure that certain objective parameters regarding the form of the bills are kept. We said, for example, that there'd be some basic legislative parameters set down from the beginning. No one deciding afterwards, okay, there's this Speaker of the House, and we're going to write out these regulations on how regarding bills and how they were voted on. No one can decide a posteriori. It would always be a priori. From the beginning, they would all know these are the rules. Very straightforward, objective rules. Like, for example, we've mentioned that bills should be small in size. And we can say maybe the number can be debated, but let's say bills can no longer cannot be more than five or ten pages long. So it's a very objective number that that anyone with an objective mind can validate. If a bill comes with 25 pages and the minimum or maximum is 10, then obviously that bill cannot be voted on. So that's what the House referee would be checking. The size of the bill. Another example that the bills have to be single topic bills. You can't have this mess of things where a bill is for to build a bridge to nowhere and build a school in some other unrelated place. Because that leads to all this bargaining and dealing. I'll vote for your bridge if you vote for my school, and all this pork that gets added as a result. No, it has to be a single topic issue. If you want to build a bridge in a school in different states and the bridge has nothing to do with the school, then each project should have its own bill. Simple as that. So it'd be single topic bills, no hodgepodge of things. And that, yes, there is a certain subjectiveness to that. What is a single topic bill? But I think that we can more or less, if we're objective, we're objective and honest, it is rather workable parameter. And the House referee would be the one who would keep track of it. So the House referee is not controlling things from a political perspective. He's just being like an administrator looking at bills from a very objective perspective and making sure that they follow certain parameters that would be laid down in the Constitution from the get-go, not by a Speaker of the House, not by a majority whip or minority whip or whatever the hell they call them. It would be these parameters that would be laid down. And this referee would be selected by the House, maybe, that could be changed. It's not necessarily set in stone, but it could be that the referee of the House referee would be selected by the House, by the representatives in the House at the time. Almost like the Speaker of the House is selected, but this one would be much more transparent. And the thing is that if the referee of the House does not do what he's supposed to do, then there'd be parameters for him being he or she being demoted. And we talked about all of that in more detail in previous audio snippets. But the thing is that the House of Representatives would be these people who are proposing bills. They don't have to pass it through a committee. They just post a bill they want to be passed. And now that we have the internet, it would be very easy in an internet environment. All the representatives can look at the bills being proposed and thumbs up, or thumbs down, or just thumbs up. And the bills that have the most thumbs up or that go beyond a certain threshold of thumbs up then become into the queue, the voting queue on the floor. There's no need for any Speaker of the House controlling anything. This can be done dynamically, organically, by individuals. And then, if I have a bill and I want people to vote for it, I can walk in up and down the hallways of Congress and start talking to all the other representatives and say, hey, did you see my bill? I think it's a great idea. And maybe we can have a debate and they can say, oh, no, I don't like your bill because you said this. Maybe if you change that, I will like it. And then I will take that into account and make the change if necessary. But as you see, it would be a very democratic and fair system where each individual has the power and then to advance bills. And if you have great ideas, then you will become more powerful, but it will be because of your ideas. And if you stop having good ideas, you will lose the power. You won't have any power based on position, if you see what I'm saying. So and we've talked about this in greater detail before. So And the other thing that we would like to emphasize, and that this is, again, a repeat of what we've said before, is that voting for these members of Congress, which we'll call MCs, members of Congress, voting for these MCs would no longer be by district. It'd be by state level. Because the problem with the district thing is that it becomes very arbitrary, and that leads to all the gerrymandering stuff that has gone on in the past, where people redraw districts to benefit a certain candidate or party. We wouldn't have that. So to avoid all that nonsense about redistricting and so forth and all the gerrymandering issues, there would be these MCs would be not selected or elected by a district, but by the whole state. So and the state's representation in the House would still be proportional to the state's population. And I say that all of this with sadness because this would have been, when I say state, I think of an American state, but this is not going to be applicable to America anymore because America is dead. This, America was supposed to enjoy all of this at some point, but it threw it all away. So all of this hopefully will someday be implemented in some other country, some other environment, or other nations, but it won't be America. So when I say state, it may sound like I'm talking about America, but I'm talking about a state or a province in any in the country, in any relevant country. So the state's representation in the House would be proportional to the state's population. So that would stay. What would happen is people would submit candidates' names, or people can submit their own names to be candidates. So they can say, I want to be a representative of the state of so-and-so. And now that we have the internet, that could be very easy and very publicly available for people to see who has thrown his or her hat in the ring to be a representative of the state. And there should be no limit on the number of candidates. Whoever wants to be a candidate, they can go in. They'll just have to fight to get the people's attention. So it's the candidate's responsibility to be known. And they must, you know, maybe every candidate would get their own ID. And they're, you know, just like on American Idol in the old days. I don't know if they have that show anymore, but if you wanted to vote for someone, you'd have to call in and press a certain code, you know, 505 for this candidate or 07 or so forth. But the thing is, every candidate would get their own ID, and the candidate would then say, vote for this ID, I'm ID so-and-so, when you go to the ballot box, vote for a candidate with the ID so-and-so. And they would have the responsibility of promoting that ID, you know, to get people to know who to vote for. So all these candidates would be, and there'd be no party. No need to win a primary, no nothing. Everyone just throws their hat in the ring, and people can choose from that. So for example, if a state has 100 representatives in Congress, then the top 100 vote-getters in a general poll would be elected, regardless of their geographical location within the state. So it doesn't matter what district they're from. The top 100 candidates who get the most votes would get elected. And in a sense, districts would be formed in a kind of organic way, even though there are no districts anymore, but they'd be formed in an organic way because every candidate will generally be able to only reach the people in a certain geographical area. You know, maybe they're not well known throughout the whole state, but they're well known in their city or their county. So they will draw a lot of votes from the people of their general area. So in a sense, districts will be formed, but they will be formed organically, not artificially the way they are now. So when it comes to voting, because there are 100 candidates, they can just vote. It's not that they just vote for one person. What they would do is they would do the ranked choice voting system, which I know conservatives despise, but that would be the way to go. So, because that's what we need if we don't want parties. But see, the conservatives are not thinking that way. Conservatives keep complaining about everything, the swamp and all this rubbish. But they never let go of the concept of the party system. Why? Because the founding fathers established it, and anything the founding fathers did is perfect. So they never go there. They never think about the possibility, oh, let's have a system that's not party centric. They complain about the rhinos and about the Republican Party getting in the way and all the politics and all this stuff and all the traitors and sellouts, but they don't understand all of that is promoted by the system. The system makes it possible for people to operate in that treacherous, murky environment. So you take out the party system and you take out a whole bunch of the contamination, but conservatives don't want to go there. But the thing is, once you take you say, let's get rid of the party system, you need a ranked choice voting system. Otherwise, it's not going to work. And between having a party system and having ranked choice voting, I'd rather have ranked choice voting, because that ensures that there is going to be a measure of democracy and independence from party control. So there would be a simple system where people would vote for the five candidates they like the most. Or they can just vote for one. If they only know one and they only care for one, they can just vote for one or two or three or four or five, but not more. So they would choose their five favorite candidates in order, you know, most favorite, second favorite, and so forth. And it'd be a simple system where the top candidate gets 5 points, the second candidate four, and 3, 2, and 1, you know. In other words, that a single person could, if they vote for five people, they are actually adding 15 points to the voting pool. Five for the first, for their top candidate, four for their second favorite, three for their third favorite, and so on. And whoever gets the most points wins, you know. And the 100, let's say if the state has 100 representatives, the top 100 point getters are the ones who go to Congress. And if there's, like, say, a region of the state that feels really unrepresented, they will naturally feel inclined to vote for local candidates only. Which will naturally increase those local candidates' chances of being elected, because everybody in their locality would be voting for them and them only. So what we're saying is that even though there's no districts, there's no districting, it would still it doesn't mean that certain parts of the state will not be represented, because if they really feel unrepresented, they will just focus on voting on for local candidates. But I think at the long term, people will just vote for whoever is best for the whole state. And that's what we want. We want to end all that regionalization, all that of balkanization of the system. And the only reason why we do divide it at the state level is that we do want a certain level of geographical division, so that all areas of the country are represented, because there is a point beyond which it's very difficult for one candidate to be known nationally. So you do have to do some sort of division of the nation, and then but that's that a division at a top level and not beyond that, because if you fractionalize it even more, then you do create, you introduce a balkanization effect. So that would be the first branch. We've said more things about that branch in the past, but that would be the first branch, the legislative branch, that is associated to the judge personality. So what would be the second branch? And this second branch is where we start differing from the current system. The second branch would have to do with the visionary personality. Visionaries are people who look to the future, who see beyond the beyond appearances. They go beyond the literal and see the invisible. And they are more idealistic, and so forth. That's what a visionary is, and that means that we would need to have a branch that represents or that reflects the visionary personality. And that's what we are going to be calling the House of Sentries. Sentry, not century, but I mean sentry, you know, like a watchman, S-N-T-R-Y, sentry. So it'd be the House of Sentries. The voting for, so what is this house going to look like and how is it going to work? Well, the voting for these sentries would be at the national level, not at the state level, as it would be with the House of Representatives. Why? Because we want people who think more globally. So, see, at the state level, we're kind of like localizing things. We want people who think beyond their local region, like people who think nationally. You know, it's like the saying in the Bible, a prophet is not honored in his own land. So people who are visionary are usually rejected by the people that are closest to them. So that's why if you restrict the voting to the state level for visionaries as well, for the House of Sentries, you would be kind of, you would be combining two things that are somewhat contradictory or that oppose each other in the metaphysical. So the voting therefore has to be at the national level. So it's not five visionaries from the state of so and so and five centuries from the state of so and so and six centuries from the state of so and so. No, it's let's say 100 centuries, and that I think that would be a fixed number. I think it has to be a fixed number regardless of population. We would have 100, let's say in a country the size of America, for example, there'd be 100 centuries. And it should be a number that's significantly less than the number of representatives. So right now, for example, in America, I think we have 400 plus representatives in the House. We would have 100 if this had been implemented in America and America was not dead, then we'd have 100 centuries. And you say, oh, well, doesn't that sound like the Senate? Hold your equines for a second, because it's not going to be like the Senate. It does sound like the Senate, but it's not. But just like the Senate right now in America, it would have 100 centuries, a significant number, significantly lower than the number of MCs, members of Congress. But it would be 100 for the whole nation. See, right now in the Senate, for example, it's 100 people, but two from each state. It wouldn't be like that with the centuries. The whole nation would have to pick the 100 people that they see are the most visionary. And it might, turn out that people will tend to vote for the people they know the most. But if I find someone visionary and I live all the way across on the other coast, I'd still have the opportunity to vote for that visionary, even if he doesn't live in my state. And that's very important. If you're a visionary, you have a broad view of things. If you see a guy way over on the other side of the country who you see as a visionary, you should be able to vote for him. So just like you're voting for visionaries, you have to allow people to be visionary to vote for visionaries, if you see what I'm trying to say. Not to be, self-contained and tunnel vision. With a tunnel vision, just voting for the people that are very close to me. If I see someone way over on the other side of the country who is a visionary, I should be able to vote for him or her to the House of Centuries. So that's why it has to be at the national level. And same voting system, people will vote for the five candidates they like the most. And whoever gets the most points, the 100 most who get the most points, they will become the centuries. And I would dare say that they should be selected to the same number of years as the House of as the MCs. I would dare say this could be up to debate, but let's give a number, but that can be modified. There's no hard set number, I would dare say, but let's say 4 years. 4 years for a century in the House of Centuries, and 4 years for the or 2 years. Let's make it 2 years or four. Who knows? For the House of Centuries, in 2 or 4 years for the House of Representatives, for the Congress. And I would think it might be a good idea to either. This is also debatable whether they would all go in at the same time, or there'd be a 2 year gap between the elections for visionary and for centuries and MCs. Those are minor details, but they would have a limited time, and I would dare say that it should be the same number of years as, you know, for both. 4 years for a member of Congress, 4 years for a century. But that could be debated. What will these centuries do? What they will do is they will look into the spirit behind the laws and the bills, you know, the laws that are being passed by the Congress, to ensure that those laws are right. So they will look into the spirit. They have to see beyond the visible and see, okay, is this right? They'll be checking. That'd be verifying, for example, the constitutionality of each law. So see, now we're beginning to see the separation. This is who has been doing this all along in America? The judicial branch. The judicial branch has been the one saying, okay, this law is constitutional, this law is not. And then they say, this law is not constitutional. They chuck it, and no one can debate it. One crazy judge decides it's not, that a law has to be thrown out, and it gets thrown out. And they can only appeal within the judicial branch. And no one outside the judicial branch can argue with that. And it's all arbitrary, because if you get a bad judge who has a weird view of the world, no one can challenge him. And usually, you know, you rarely win on appeal. So once you start challenging a judge, it's an uphill battle. So one of the things that would be taken away from the judicial branch would be this thing. This is something the centuries would do. People dedicated to that, looking into the constitutionality of every law and ensuring, for example, that they all uphold the 10 pillars that we would define. So they'd be looking at these ideas and principles. The 10 pillars include the 5 rights of the individual and the 5 pillars of what authority looks like. So, for example, the third pillar talks about not using power for self-aggrandizement or self-promotion or self-gain. So if they see a law that is somehow promoting the personal interests of politicians, the ones who pass the law, then the centuries can say, this is a violation of the third pillar. So that'd be kind of that's what they would be doing. That's why we're calling them sentries, because they're like watchmen, watching over the laws being passed, and they're looking at the spirit. Like, is there a violation of a human right here? That was in, you know, because sometimes the Congress can become so caught up in drafting the law and the details of the law that they miss the forest for the trees. Because they're focused on the details, and then the century has the wider picture and says, oh, no, see, you got so caught up writing this bill that all the details that you didn't realize that you're violating the right to property here, or you're violating the right to life. So that's what these people would be doing. And they'd be checking not only national laws, but laws at all levels. national, state, and local. So if there's a, this is an exaggeration, but if there's like a law somewhere in some county, some remote county, that brings back slavery or some form of slavery, some form of masked slavery, then they would be, that'd be their job. They'd be looking at laws from all over the place. It's like a random job, like an investigator, you could say. And they'd be looking and reading through local laws, and then they find this law that brings back slavery in a mass way. They can point it out and say, hey, this violates the right to life, or, you know, and so forth. So they would be checking laws at all levels. And that'd be calling out the laws that are violating principles or that have something wrong in their spirit. But they and they'd also be checking trial verdicts or suggestions made by judges for potential new laws. So in other words, they would all, besides checking all laws at all levels, they will also be looking at verdicts and see if there's something wrong with certain verdicts. And they'd also be looking through the list of suggestions that judges make when laws are incomplete. We've talked about this before, that, for example, if a judge has a case where the law is not clear on who, you know, on what the right verdict is, the judge can issue an interim verdict, and he or she would be obligated to tell Congress, hey, whether it be the state Congress or the national Congress, whatever level the law was passed, and say, hey, the law is incomplete. You need to clarify this. And I made an interim judgment based on my own opinion, you know. But it's like a referee in a football game. He can make a call based on his instinct, but if he finds out that the regulations are not clear on what the right call is in that play, he should tell the federation or whatever that they need to clarify the law or the rule in that, so that the next time something similar happens in a game or a match, they can objectively say what the right decision is. So these sentries would be looking at all these suggestions being posted by judges to see and to kind of point out, okay, we really need a law to fill this gap in our legal system and so forth. So that's what they would be doing, checking all the time. But so they'd be doing all these checkings, but what would they be doing with all their results? Well, first, they would have like a budget constitutionally assigned to them, a reasonable budget, not too much, not too little, a budget to reach out to the American people with their thoughts. So they would have a platform to speak to the American people and say, this is what we're finding, this is what we're seeing. And they can do it either individually or collectively through things that they vote for collectively. But each individual sentry can post their own thoughts, even if it differs from all the other 99 sentries' thoughts. They can post their own ideas, and it would be available. People would be able to go to a website or whatever and read what they're saying and thinking, because that would influence who they vote for in the next election. So that'd be one thing. But aside from having that that influence of opinion or of just making comments about laws and verdicts and things like that, and also they'd be suggesting changes to the fundamental structure of the legal system, like amendments. Like if they see, okay, we need an amendment in the Constitution to deal with this or that or the other, they'd be the ones with that. See, the legislative branch would be the one kind of thinking about all the details, all those specific laws that rule the land. But sometimes they might get caught up in so much minutia that they would miss the bigger picture. And maybe we need an amendment and no one in the legislative branch is realizing it. So then the visionaries would come and say, hey, we need an amendment that says something like this. This will help us, and so forth. So, but aside from having this voice of giving opinions about things, they will have a certain amount of power. And what will be the power? They will have three types of voting. One type would be declarations. Like someone issues a declaration, and then they would vote on it. And if it's a majority, then they would post it as the House of Centuries has declared this. Because it was voted on, and the majority of centuries voted for it. So they'd have declarations. But they also would be able to vote on bills, to draft a bill of their own and vote on it. But that doesn't mean it would become law immediately. It would mean that that bill, if it's passed, then it can go to Congress and be submitted to be voted on. But the advantage of it, for example, let's say that 51, let's say that it passed by 55 to 45 vote in the House of Centuries, then that bill would go and be included or added to the queue of bills to be voted on in Congress. Because at the end of the day, every law has to be passed through Congress. No one else can issue laws on their own. It always has to go through Congress. So Congress would get that bill, but the advantage of it would be that bill would start off with 55 thumbs up, if you see what I'm saying. It would get all the 55 people who voted for it, with their thumbs up would be there. So that means that it would get moved up in the queue much more quickly than other bills drafted inside Congress, if that makes any sense. So and then the third type of voting would be on bills passed by Congress. In other words, let's say the Congress passes a bill, Bill A. Then the House of Centuries can vote on that bill and see if they like it. They can decide if they want to vote for it. And let's say there's the major objection to it. So someone submits it for voting, and it gets enough thumbs up in the House of Centuries to be submitted for voting. So it gets voted on the floor. And if 2/3 of the people vote against the bill passed by Congress, Bill A, then that will give them veto power and the bill will be stopped. So even though it was passed by Congress, the House of Centuries can veto the bill by a 2/3 majority. But that means the bill can go back to Congress, and if Congress votes for it by a 2/3 majority of their own, they can override the Centuries' veto. So the Centuries do have a certain power to stop certain laws, aside from just saying, oh, I don't like this law, or this law needs to be changed, or whatever. Or aside from suggestions and opinions, they do have a veto power, but it's a 2/3 majority to veto a bill passed by Congress. But Congress can override that veto by a 2/3 vote of their own. And the thing is, even if the bill was passed with 99% majority, if the House of Centuries vetoes it, it has to go back for a second vote, because maybe the House of Centuries will make comments that will force all the people who voted for the bill to rethink their bill and say, I voted for it the first time, but I won't vote for it for the second time. And the second time, they might not be able to get the 2/3 needed to override the veto. So those would be the three types of voting that they have. Voting for like general declarations, voting for bills of their own that would get automatically put in the queue in the Congress system for Congress to approve it. So they can draft their own bills. They have the power to do that. And not only as a group, they can also propose bills individually. So if one sentry has an idea, he can draft a bill and put it in the queue in Congress. And obviously it will start with one thumb up, his own thumb up, thumbs up. And then if the people in Congress like it, it will start getting voted on as well. So then if it's good enough, it will eventually get voted on and approved. If they have a bill, as we said, passed, when they vote on a bill of their own, then they, if it passes by a majority, it can be sent to the House of Representatives with all the thumbs up votes from them being transferred to the Congress, as we tried to explain a moment ago. So you could say, if you're hearing this, some of you might say, okay, this sounds very familiar, it has a certain similarity to the House of Lords in the UK. So I'm reading here right now from the House of Lords article on Wikipedia. It says here, the House of Lords is the upper house of the Parliament of the United Kingdom. Like the lower house, the House of Commons, it meets in the Palace of Westminster in London, England, one of the oldest institutions in the world. Its origins lie in the early 11th century and the emergence of bicameralism in the 13th century. In contrast, the House of Commons membership of the Lords is not generally acquired by election. Most members are appointed for life on either a political or a non-political basis. Hereditary membership was abolished in 1999, save for 92 accepted hereditary peers. It says here, no members directly inherit their seats any longer. The House of Lords includes up to 26 archbishops and bishops of the Church of England. So see, the thing about the Church of England kind of emphasizes that the House of Lords is looking at the more spiritual angle of things. And that's what these sentries would be doing. They'd be looking at the spirit of the law and seeing, okay, this law may look good on the outside, but is there something beneath it that is not right? If there's something that is crooked that needs to be exposed, because this is what these sentries will do. They will be exposing hidden things, things that are not being noticed, like a law, an obscure law somewhere that is violating people's rights. They would expose it. That's what these like bringing to light, unmasking the secrets of the heart of people. That's what these sentries would be doing. It says here, as the upper house of parliament, the House of Lords has many similar functions to the House of Commons. It scrutinizes legislation, holds the government to account, and considers and reports upon public policy. Kind of what we were saying a moment ago. It'd be like the House of Sentries would be making comments about laws and making statements and declarations and reporting on things. And they would, for example, also look at the way, government money is being used in projects and say, okay, this bill was passed 5 years ago and we're building a bridge to nowhere, and they would be reporting on it and making state declarations to the public about how bad a project is being run. So they'd be exposing all these things in declarations. And that has a lot of political influence, even if they are not, directly in power to change things right off the bat. They can point it out and cause the ripple effect. That will cause a ripple effect in the political atmosphere, in Congress, and everywhere, for people to change if they're actually exposing something legitimate. So kind of similar to what the House of Lords here does. It says here, peers may also seek to introduce legislation or propose amendments to bills. Same thing we were saying a moment ago. So any member of the House of Sentries can propose a bill in Congress as if they were congressmen. It says here, while it's unable to prevent bills passing into law, except in certain limited circumstances, may delay the enactment of bills for up to 1 year. Similar. Not exactly the same, but similar to what we were saying. And you may think, oh, we're copying from here. No, it's not. This was like a separately drafted thought, you could say, and it matches with the House of Lords in some ways, but not in all. But the House of Centuries cannot generally prevent bills, but they can veto them by a two-thirds majority. So they do have a certain power that the House of Lords doesn't have, even though the House of Lords can delay the enactment of a bill for up to a year, and they can also, in limited circumstances, prevent a bill being passed, being approved. So it says, in this capacity, as a body independent from the pressures of the political process, the House of Lords is said to act as a revising chamber, focusing on legislative detail, whilst occasionally asking the House of Commons to reconsider its plans. So yeah, so see that they can call out the House of Commons and say, hey, you're doing this wrong, or you need to think about this. So as you can see, there's a lot of similarity with the House of Lords, but it's not a Senate, and it's not a House of Lords. I hope that makes sense. So that's the second branch. So let's go into the third branch, and I think we'll stop it there if we can finish this branch. The third branch would be a branch that has to do with the conqueror personality. That would be the third personality. So it has to be a person with a conqueror, so leader, a person that people will follow to the ends of the earth. A person who convinces others, who has an ability to change the hearts of others, the will of others, and convince them to do things that they probably were not inclined to do originally. So as you can see, all of that points to the presence of a great leader, hence it points to a president. So we would have a president, but it's a different president from the one we have now. And just as a side note, as you may know, the word president is something that it's a term that was invented in America. You know, people, I don't think before America, the birth of the United States, people would not refer to the leader of their country as the president. And they might have used the word president for other contexts, but not as, you know, for the leader of a country. And America was the first one to start using that term. And if I'm not mistaken, the second country to start using that term, oddly enough, was Haiti. I think in 1807, I could be wrong, but Haiti instituted their first president, and they decided to call him the president of Haiti, and using the same term as America, you know, was using for its leader. So, the word president is used everywhere. So that shows you the influence that America has had on the world, on the way the world chooses to govern itself. And that's why it was so important for if America had stayed alive and not died in September of 2023, that, if America had continued living, we would have implemented all these ideas. And then because of our influence in the rest of the world, everybody else would have just followed suit. Because, you know, if America's doing it, let's do it too. And then it would have just created this cascade of people, of countries adopting this new system. But America died, so America's, you know, in a sense, gone to hell. So it will be some other country's task to propagate this to the rest of the world. So now the thing is that this conqueror or this president will not be in charge of an executive branch the way it is now, the way we have it now. And the reason is that the executive branch, that branch is crooked. And I don't mean that in a political sense. I mean in a metaphysical sense. That branch is crooked because it's not doesn't fit into metaphysical reality. What happens with the executive branch is that if the president is in charge of the executive branch, you create a conflict of interest. And what do you mean? What do we mean by that? Well, I mean, what does the word executive make you think of? Executive is someone who executes. And what is the executive branch executing? They're executing the laws passed by Congress. So the Congress passes laws, creates organizations or departments or whatever, and then the president under the current system is supposed to execute the laws passed by Congress. But then that creates a conflict of interest because shouldn't the people who pass the laws be the ones who are in charge of having them executed so that they get executed the way they wanted them to be executed? Right now, the thing is, the Congress passes laws, and then the president gets to pick and choose what laws he wants to execute and which ones he wants to look the other way with. That's why we have the immigration problems that we have, because and then the president on top of that starts making up his own executive orders and laws. So then we have a conflict of interest, because if we have an executive branch that is supposed by its very name to execute the laws passed by Congress, but then that executive branch is being run by a person with different interests, so we create a conflict of interest. And then the laws that were passed are not executed the way they should have been, so then we get a tainted result, because we don't know, was it the execution of the law that was the problem, or was the law itself? It creates this ambiguity and this problem that we constantly have. And then on top of that, we have the problem in America that started when we tried to fight the spoil system, which was a big mistake. And when we get back to 1876 and 1880, and we continue talking about America in that time period, we may re-explain that a little better, but we made the mistake of going away from the spoil system and thinking it was so corrupt. We replaced it with something else that was at the end of the day even worse, where we entrenched bureaucrats, I think through the Pendleton Act, I think it was called, if I'm not mistaken, and some other acts, we entrenched a bureaucracy into the executive branch that is there for life. And then when a president comes along and he wants to execute laws, he cannot, because he's stuck with a bureaucrat that he cannot fire. And then the bureaucrat does his own thing, and if he's allied to a certain party, then he does it his own way, and no, he's not accountable to anyone, because the president can't fire him. The Congress has no control over him because he's not inside the legislative branch, is inside the executive branch, a separate independent branch. It just creates a mess. It's a total mess, because the executive branch, every time I think about this in the past, I go, there's something wrong with this. But I could never put my exact finger on it. Now I understand what was wrong. The executive branch is supposed to execute the laws of Congress. So therefore, Congress should be the one in charge of the executive division of government, not the president. So he's not in charge of any executive branch to avoid any conflict of interest that we have in the current system. So what is he going to do then? Well, he's going to, at a general level, embody the will of the people. When people vote for the president, it's like they're putting in one person. One person who represents the will, the collective will of the people, which is different from Congress. Congress, in a sense, represents the will of the people, but it's divided into all these fractions, and then everyone has their regional interests in mind and all that. But there's this one person who represents the national will of the people, and who has the national will or national well-being at heart. And that's what's different about the president as opposed to the Congress. So in that one sense, he embodies the will of the people. He personifies what the people want. So that's one thing. And he, just like the House of Sentries, will have a budget to reach out to the American people with his or her thoughts. So he can influence the will of the people. And as a conqueror, he can evangelize and talk to people and try to convert them to ideas. And he will also be reaching out to people to say, what do you want? What do you want? And have people evangelize him about what they want. So there's going to be a mutual evangelization between the president and the people. But he should have a budget, reasonable budget, not too much, not too little, to reach out to the American people and be on tours and talking to people and doing whatever is necessary to understand, to convince people to do things or to think a certain way or to hear what they have to say about things. And aside from that promotional duty, you could say, and also he because he embodies the will of the people, he should have the freedom to go into Congress and walk down the halls of Congress and talk to congressmen and congresswomen and tell them the people want this, the people want that, and try to be a force of influence in their voting. But he cannot pass a law, and that's the important thing. It's always Congress that passes a law. He cannot issue executive orders and say, oh, let's let all the illegals in, or let's send them all back to Mexico. No, whether it be good or bad, he cannot do it. It's not his job to do it. That's Congress's job. And Congress will have an executive division to do that. And we will talk about that later. Not in this audio snippet. Well, I don't think there's enough time for that. But the thing is that he will not have the power to pass laws or regulations, but he can propose bills in the House of in Congress. So just like the House of Sentries, just like the Sentries, he can propose a bill. He can say submit a bill, and he will get one thumbs up from him, and then if the Congress people like it, they will give it thumbs up, and if it gets enough thumbs up, it will immediately pass to be voted on the floor and so forth and go through the same process as any other bill. But he can propose a bill, and that's a lot of power. So that he can put a bill in the queue. As a single individual, he can go ahead and do that as if he were another member of Congress. And he will have access to speak to the Congress and to the Sentries, to the House of Representatives and to the House of Sentries. He will be able to go talk to them and have the floor and ask for, a date to talk to them and have a speech with them. And if he wants to televise them or stream it online or whatever, he should have the budget to do that. Within certain limitations, he shouldn't be going to speak to the giving speeches in the House and every day, because that would be a waste of everybody's time. But he should be allowed a certain latitude, to the freedom to address both houses, at periodic intervals of his choosing, without being over the top. He should also have access to talk to anyone, to any sentry, any MC, anytime he or she wants. So he can talk to the House, to both houses collectively, as a House, to each, or individually, to each individual representative or each MC or sentry. He will also have, just like the House of Sentries, he will have the power to veto a bill single-handedly. Since he is his own majority, if he votes for veto, that's 100% majority. So he doesn't have to have two-thirds majority because he is 100% or zero. So he can vote single-handedly, veto a bill, and again, Congress can override that veto by a two-thirds vote majority. So if the president vetoes a bill, it has to go to a second vote. But if it gets two-thirds majority on that second vote, then the veto is overridden, just like with the House of Sentries. So he does have power, legislative power in that sense, but it's just to veto. he can't create new laws. He can propose new laws, but he cannot enact them. And he can also vote against a House of Centuries veto. And so this is this might not be a good idea. It depends. But it seems like a good idea that he can also veto a House of Centuries veto, if that makes any sense. So, and if he does that, then he can reduce the vote override threshold from 2/3 to 60%. So in other words, he will have certain influence in that sense too. So for example, if the Congress passes a bill, the House of Centuries vetoes the bill, but the president opposes the veto of the Centuries, then when it goes to vote a second time in Congress, it won't need 2/3 for the veto to be overridden. It will only need 60%. That's a small decrease in the percentage, but it might be enough to make it pass. So as if to say, if the president and the Congress gang up on the Centuries, they can make a bill pass more easily, which makes sense. I mean, the president has to have a certain power, ability to influence, and that so that means that he can affect what happens in Congress, and he can affect what happens with the century with when the Centuries veto something. And another thing, responsibility he will have is he will be in charge of the nation's military, not the Congress, not the Centuries. He's the commander in chief. He's the conqueror. He's the leader. So he will, just like the we have it now in the current system, he will be the leader of the nation's military, and he will have the authority to direct military actions and not be micromanaged by anyone. And more or less kind of like what it is now. So if he wants to have a certain fight war strategy, he can choose it. It's his choice. He's the commander. And he can start, and this is going to be a little controversial to say, but he can start wars as needed. If he wants to start a war, he can start it. And you can say, well, that's not right. Well, it's been done anyway. That's been done anyway. We always complain about the president starting a certain conflict, and because in the current constitution, only Congress can do a declaration of war. But we've had conflicts where there has never been a declaration of war, but we fought the war anyway. So let's stop with the self delusion. Let's say the president as the commander in chief. That's the responsibility of the people. If they choose a nut job for president, then he will start nut job wars, and that's the people's fault. But he should have that freedom to start wars. He's a conqueror. You can't repress that. If he wants to start a war, he can start it. But Congress and the Centuries can voice their thoughts on military action. So they can say, oh, we don't like this war. We have certain doubts. They can criticize what he's starting. And also, they can force the president to stop or even start military actions, but only by a bill that passes by a certain high majority. I would dare say by a 2/3 majority. So just like they can override the Centuries veto by 2/3 majority, they can override a president's veto by 2/3 majority. They can also override a president's decision, a military decision, by 2/3 majority. So, and the Centuries can veto. So in other words, if Congress doesn't like a war that the president started, they can draft a bill against saying the war has to be stopped. And if it passes by a 2/3 majority, then they can stop the war. But the Centuries can veto that bill, just like any other bill. So if the Centuries are in agreement with the war, they can veto the bill, and it goes through the same process. And also, the Centuries can propose a bill to stop or start military actions, just like they would with any other bill. So if they don't like the war, they can pass their own bill saying the war should be stopped. That bill then goes to the Congress and gets voted on, just like any other bill. But the thing is that it should be constitutionally established, and this is kind of a difficult parameter to define, but at least in general principle, it should be stated that any bill to alter military action should not try to micromanage a war. And that parameter should be enforced by the House's HR, by the Congress's HR, and by the sentries. So if there's a bill that says, the number of tanks for this military, the number of tanks that should be sent to defend France's border should be 40 instead of the 50 that the president is proposing. That's micromanagement. So a bill like that should not even make see the light of day, because the HR, the House referee in Congress, should shoot it down and say, no, this is unconstitutional. This does not follow the parameters that the Constitution establishes for a valid bill. And the sentry should also be on the lookout and say, hey, you're micromanaging in that bill. That bill should be annulled. And they can call out that law, that bill, and veto it immediately, because they see that it's trying to micromanage the war. The president is the conqueror. The president is the one who should be allowed a certain freedom to do what he needs. And yes, obviously, if he gets us into a war that is wrong, the Congress and the sentries can stop him, but they have to do it by a two-thirds majority. And he also, the president, would represent the country in international affairs, the way it is now, more or less. So he's the country's spokesperson. He's the face of the country to the rest of the world. He can propose treaties, just like now, but he cannot enact them on his or her own, just like now. And he will act as a sort of intermediary between foreign entities and Congress. So he can go negotiate things and come back to Congress and say, hey, China or whatever said this or that or the other, or some other, let's say the UK or Germany proposed this, and they want an alliance with us, and they want a trade thing going on. And he can come and speak to Congress on behalf of what some foreign entity said to him. So he would be acting as that sort of intermediary. And that would be his role. He would not be managing the Department of Education. He would not be managing he can have a say on how education is. If he listens to the people and the people say, the education system sucks and we need to change it, he can go and say, okay, I propose these changes, and talk and say to the Congress, you guys are dropping the ball on education, and you need to fix this, that, and the other. So he can be that spokesperson for the American people, but he cannot define or run the Department of Education. He cannot run the Department of Energy. That's, for example, that's so ridiculous right now. One of the only good thing that came out of the Trump era was that we became a self-reliant nation in terms of energy production. We became the largest producer of oil, if I'm not mistaken, in the world. Something that when I was a kid, I never thought I'd hear that. Because when I was a kid, it was OPEC, and I thought we were going to be dependent on them forever. And during the Trump years, oil production, domestic oil production, just skyrocketed. Energy production, and that's why we had such a booming economy. That was the only good thing he did. Everything else was half baked and or bad. But that was his one good thing, because he enabled. And then Biden came in, and the first thing he did was to stifle all of that domestic production. And that's why he started relying on the Ukrainian war as an excuse to justify the inflation and the economic collapse that would ensue. He wanted to blame the Russians for what he was doing domestically. That's why they chose to defend or support Ukraine, because it became a weapon to justify their economic collapse, the collapse that they were provoking. So that was part of it. But the point I'm trying to make is, how can a president, how can we just change presidents and that decides how much oil we produce, how much energy we produce? That is ridiculous. How can that one man decide something that he has no authority over? And that's because we have because he runs the Department of Energy, so he can draft regulations. He can decide, okay, we're not going to grant this federal land to this company for drilling. We can do this. We can stop this project. We can stop that project. We can draft some fake regulation to prevent someone drilling oil somewhere. And all is coming from the president. If he has the right people in the bureaucracy to enable it, because if he doesn't, then it's a disaster. Someone else is deciding things. But the thing is, he should have no authority over any of that. It's not his job. It's not his job. And when we gave him that job, we created a disaster, a conflict of interest. And that's why we are in great part in the mess that we are. So here you can see that each branch, we've defined it with clear boundaries so far. Everything is very clear. And we have two more branches to go. And then we'll revisit one of them, I believe, later on. And then we'll have our five branches of government well defined. And that's how it will, it should be, should have been. And hopefully one of these days, there will be a country out there that will implement these ideas and be an example to the world that we were supposed to be in America, but decided not to be. So, that's it for now. We'll continue with the other two branches in, another audio snippet, hopefully. Thank you very much for listening.